Bottom of Daf Ayin Tes Amud Aleph, 1.5 lines up from the bottom. We're continuing the Braisa, but this part of the Braisa is independent of the previous part of the Braisa. Kishem shakarka niknes bekesef b'shtar uvechazaka kach schirus niknes bekesef b'shtar uvechazaka. There are three methods of acquiring karka, real estate. That means that the owner of the real estate could transfer ownership and the buyer can acquire ownership in one of three different possible ways, either through kesef, shtar, or chazaka. And the Brice establishes that the same three methods apply to schirus. Schirus is rental. And the Gemara now clarifies what the Brice has in mind. Schirus demai. What is being rented over here? Because although in the reisha of this part of the reisha, it's clear and it's explicit that we're referring to karka, it's not so clear in the sefer. For example, if you go ice skating, you go to the rink, you rent ice skates. And that's the first possibility that the Gemara is going to investigate and reject. Ilema. And here we begin. I'm renting ice skates. Is metaltele b'nei shtora ninhu. Although it's possible and logical that two out of the three of these kinyonim, of these methods of acquiring ownership, could apply to rental in metaltele and in movable objects, and that would be chazaka and kesef. Kesef is your classical kinyon in metaltele, as we'll soon see. And chazaka, which makes sense, that I demonstrate bailus by using it and enjoying it. I do something that a bailum would normally do, and that expresses my ownership. That becomes symbolically a maisa kinyan, to take it into the rishus of the socher in this particular case. So just like in karka, a person demonstrates his ownership on the karka, either because he makes a permanent change in the karka, he improves the karka, he puts up a fence around the karka, or perhaps he harvests the land, and so forth and so on. So too in metaltelin, that could logically be a kinyan, but shtar does not apply in the case of metaltelin, which means that I cannot give you ownership on a movable object. I can't transfer ownership through the method of shtar. The Gemara in Masechta Kiddushin, which is called in the Yeshiva's Masechta Kinyonim, tells us that although metaltelin on niknin bekesef, and what that means is that there are two dimensions to kinyonim. One full dimension, a full kinyan, means he actually owns the gufa chefetz, but there's a lower notch kind of a kinyan, we'll call it a quasi kinyan, which generates what's called a mishapara. It becomes a moral, a binding obligation to transfer ownership to something, and that's clinched with kesef. So for example, if I own a table, which is metaltelin, and I receive from you, the buyer, kesef, even though you haven't made yet what's called a kinyan yad, you haven't actually implemented a physical kinyan on the guf hachefetz on this table, you didn't drag it, you didn't pick it up. Nevertheless, there is a mishapara, which is a kind of a klala, because of if the mocher backs out of the deal, if I back out of the deal, chas v'shalom, I get a mishapara. Mishapara is a kind of a whammy, a curse. Misha par midara mabul, umidara flogo yifra, mi misha eno omed bidiburo. Nevertheless, that's only when the mocher and the machne received kesef for these metaltelin. But let's say he received a shtar. A shtar doesn't operate with regard to metaltelin at all. Ki hu zed, totally meaningless. It doesn't even generate a moral obligation incumbent upon the shoulders of the mocher, the machne, to transfer ownership over the metaltelin, because metaltelin basically are excluded from a kinyan shtar, and that's clear in the sugyas in Bav Metzia on Daf Memtes. And why is it that shtar is meaningless as far as metaltalin is concerned? Here we have two explanations. One explanation is more of a mechanical, technical failure of shtaros, because with regard to karka, which is designated by clear-cut boundaries, which are called meitzarim, those are the gvulos of the karka, and they are well known, and they are well surveyed, the shtar could delineate exactly which piece of karka is being sold, is being included in this contract. And the shtar will delineate the borders and the boundaries of the karka, so it's well defined. It's what's called a davar mesuyam. But in the case of metaltalin, since metaltalin look very similar one to the other, it's impossible to be mesayim a karka, to explicate in the shtar exactly which object is being sold. And that's the opinion of the Rashba, and that's in Bava Basra on Daf Ayin Vav. The Ran, back in the sugya of Kinyonim in Bava Metzia, is of the opinion that according to the Rashba, if you can be Mesayim Metaltalin, if Elsie the cow has a certain simon, you know, her name or her number is attached to her ear, then shtar would be effective, according to the Rashba, with regard to metaltalin. The barrier between shtar and metaltalin is more of a technical barrier that can be overcome in certain particular circumstances. However, the Rashba here in Masechta Bava Kama has a different approach, an alternative approach to understanding why shtaros are ineffective with regard to a kinyan on metaltalin. And he writes, based on the drasha, the derivation in the Gemara in Kiddushin Chavav, the Gemara derives kinyan shtar from the pasuk in Yirmiyahu, uksov b'sefer v'chasom. You remember that Yirmiyahu purchased a land in Eretz Yisrael as a symbolic act that we will return to the land even after the Golus. And there it says, uksov b'sefer v'chasom. We're talking about a shtar which serves as a kinyan karka. Again, because the purchaser was on a piece of real estate. Says the Rashba here, that since the source for kinyan shtaros is this pasuk referring to karka, therefore shtar is effective only in kinyan karka based on this source. There's no source and no basis for an effective kinyan shtaros with regard to metaltalin. And under this understanding of the Rashba, one is tempted to assume that metaltalin are completely mufka, they're completely excluded from shtar. In other words, a metaltalin object does not lend itself to a kinyan shtar. And therefore, even if you could circumvent the technical barrier and you were able to be mesamein and specify exactly in the shtar what metaltalin is being transferred, you can make a simon ledovar, and it would be a clear designation. Nevertheless, according to the Rashba here in Bava Kama, shtaros would not be meaningful as far as a kinyan metaltalin. As we said at the outset, even with regard to a mishapara, if the makne received a shtar metaltalin, he could back out of the deal. There is no moral commitment, and he would not be subject to any sort of a kloa if he backed down from the deal. So therefore, by process of elimination, we cannot assume that the brisa, in the case of schirus, applying, as it were, all three possible alternative methods of kinyan, would be referring to metaltalin, to someone who's renting ice skates, because, at least in the case of shtaros, for one, there's no possibility of assuming that shtar would be meaningful for metaltalin. Amar Rav Chisda, therefore, by process of elimination, we're referring to schirus karka. And the chiddush in the brisa is that when a person rents a piece of property, then that schirus would be clinched through one of three methods. Either because the socher gives the maskir kesef, or he gives him a shtar, and in the shtar it says, beti, beti, beti means my bias, or Basi Muskar Lecha is rented to you. That's what the Makna writes in the Shtar. Every Shtar Kinyan is written in the language of the Makna, and the Makna hands over the Shtar to the Kona, and that clinches the Kinyan. And finally, a Kinyan Chazaka would work on this house that's being rented when the Socher, the renter, goes into the house and he enjoys the benefit of the house as any Bailam, as any owner would. The Mishnah earlier on Amud Aleph tells us that a Ganav, once he makes a Kinyan Meshicha on the Behema, he is Kone for all Chiyuve Gneva. And now the Gemara wants to go into some detail about how this Kinyan Meshicha is effectuated. Omar Abelazar, Ra'uhu Shehitmin Becharshin Vitavach Umachar Mishalim Tashlume Arba Vechamisha. What was the nature of this Gneva such that it engenders, if the Ganav sells or slaughters the animal that he stole, he is chayev dalid vehe? And Rabbi Loza's description of this gneva is relevant not just because the man is going to take away someone else's animal and he's going to remove it from this yar, this forest where the animals are brought to graze, but also the detailed description of this gneva is going to be critical to answer another question. What is the difference between gneva and gzela? And that's the sugya that we're about to embark upon now. We've discussed already in the Mishnah kinyane gneva, which engender the chiyuv of kefel and dalet vehei. But what are the circumstances? How would you describe the gneva in such a way that it would qualify to engender these chiyuvim of kefel, dalet vehei? Because gneva is not gzela. With regard to gzela, there is no obligation of kefel and dalet vehei. Veishev is a gzela shar gazal. Of course, the gazlan has to return the keren, but not any other the chiyuvei tashlumei ganav. And Rabbi Lozer is revealing to us that this ganav is hitmin b'chorshin. Now again, what this hitmin is referring to, hitmin means to conceal, is hitmin referring to the ganav's concealing of himself? He's hiding himself. And the word b'chorshin is a reference to a yar, a forest. So in the forest, if we assume that the word hitmin is referring to the ganav himself is hidden in the yar. He's hidden by the foliage, the growth of the yar, and then he jumps out to steal one of the animals that's grazing there in the forest. The other interpretation is that hitmin b'charshin is a reference to the stolen object, meaning the animal that he steals, that's being concealed. We're going to start with the first approach, and that is that the ganav himself is hitmin, he is hiding himself. Rashi and Tosas Divya Maskel hitmin seem to interpret that he hid himself, he concealed himself. That's the key to the definition of a ganav. A ganav is not bold and brazen going out, you know, in front of the, you know, in front of the spectators, and the naked eye can see him going and stealing something, grabbing something. No, we're talking about a ganav. A ganav hides himself, he jumps out, he makes sure that nobody sees him. However, the Ravid quoted here in the Rashba is of the opinion that hitmin b'charshin means hitmin es habehema bein anfei hailonos. He hides, as it were, the animal that he steals amongst the foliage. The Rambam in Perek Beis Milchas Gneva seems to imply that he does both. He hides himself together with the animal in this thick You know, the thick forest, the thick greenery of the forest. There's another important point here that has to be made as far as the word Charshin is concerned, which is the Yar. And this is made by the Tosfos Rid, that a Charshin is not called a Rishus HaRabin, even though technically anyone could go into the forest. The forest is Hefkerveld, it's ownerless. But nevertheless, you will not find at any particular moment masses of people in a forest. Okay, individuals go and shepherds go in to bring the animals, as opposed to a Rishus HaRabin, says the Tosfos Rid, which is a public thoroughfare where you find many people. Then, according to Tosfos Rid, that Gneva, by definition, is called Gzela. And it matters not whether he sneaks his hand into someone's pocket to pickpocket him or not, but people will see him in Rishus HaRabin. That's the Chazok of Rishus HaRabin, because many people are there. And those people will notify the Bailim that this person has stolen or is in the process of stealing something. That's a bold, brazen gazlan. Here, he's Charshin. Charshin means that he's in a place where very few people inhabit or visit that place. Now, Rabbi Loza says that he's Chayev Dalet Vehei B'Torah's Ganov. Amai, so the Gemara asks, Ha Lo Moshach. First and foremost, we go back to the first point that we made as an extension of our discussion of the Mishnah, that you need, in order to incur Chiyuve Gneva of Kefal Dalvei, you need a Maisa Kinyan, a Maisa Meshicha. Here, it doesn't seem that the Ganav did a Maisa Meshicha. He's just hiding the animal and hiding himself. So the Gemara vacillates here in the Havamin, and then Omar of Chizda Sheikisha B'Makel in the Maskana, as to what exactly was the Meshicha that he implemented in this forest. And the Gemara assumed in the Havamina that there was no real possibility of Meshicha in this forest. And the Gemara answers there's another method, a Tsuras Meshicha, which can size up to the requirements and cuts through the Meshicha, and that is Hikisha B'Makel. And basically, Meshicha doesn't mean that the physical schlepping, the dragging of the animal with the power and the force of the Ganav, or any Kona for that matter, is the only way that you can implement Meshicha. Meshicha means to cause the animal to move, to pick up its hands, the forelegs and the back legs, and replace and put them down again in a different place. That shift in the location of the animal, which was caused by the Kona, that itself constitutes Meshicha. And therefore, Hikisha B'Makel means that if he causes the animal to move, that itself constitutes Meshicha. And the Ravid here, quoted by the Rashba, wants to say there's an additional Chiddush here in Rabbi Lozer, and that is that a Meshicha in one form or another, whether it's literally dragging the animal or hitting the animal and causing it to move, can be effective even in a Yar. We would think that a Yar is a place which is so, shall we say, public in nature that Meshicha is not valid, because Meshicha means taking it into your Rishus. The Kone, through Meshicha, takes it into his Rishus. Can he do so in a Yar? Says the Ravid, that's the Chiddush of Yar. The Rashba is not happy with this Ravid because he thinks there's no Chiddush that Yar is meaningful or is a valid place for a Kinyan, for a valid Kinyan Meshicha, because we have our Lach of Simta that we discussed before, and the Yar is not a public place in the same sense that a Rishus HaRabim is a public thoroughfare and there's no Meshicha into a Rishus HaRabim, but rather a Simta, which is a point that's off the, a place, a location that's off the center of the Rishus HaRabim, that lends itself to a Kinyan Meshicha. And therefore the Ravid says that the Chiddush here is that even though people can see him in a Yar, he's still not considered a Gazlan because he hides himself in the Yar, and therefore he's considered a Ganav, and he's Chayev Chiyuvei Gneva. And here at this point, we want to mention an interesting question of Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz. If we assume, says Tosfos Rabbeinu Peretz, that the words Hidmin Becharshin are referring to the Behema itself, that he hides the Behema, which was the Ravid's Pshat, if you recall, why does the Gemara ask, where's the Mashicha? If he was Matmin the Behema, that itself is Mashicha. He must have dragged the Behema in order to cover it. It was, you know, being shepherded outdoors and exposed. Anyone can see it. Now he grabs it, drags it into a hidden place. And perhaps the answer is that he didn't actually pull it with his hands, but rather he called it, and somehow by what's called garbo bekolo, which means he yelled out to it, he caused the animal to move, and that's how he was able to cover it over and hide it. In any event, it could be that the Makshan understood that the word hitmin is referring to the person himself. He hit himself. And therefore he says, wait a minute, where was the Mashicha? And the Taritzin says, no, hitmin means that he hid the Behema, and therefore he pulled the Behema over to a hidden place. Now, if you're careful about the language here of Rabbi Lazar, he doesn't say Ganav V'tavach U'machar, which is the classical language. He says Hitmin V'tavach U'machar. And that sounds like he didn't do a kinyan. Had he said Ganav, Ganav would imply a kinyan. That's what Geneva is, it's a kinyan. But Hitmin sounds like he just jumped to the stage of Tavach U'machar and skipped over Mashicha. That's what bothered the Gemara here, V'halo Halo Moshach. The Gemara asks Akasha now, Amre. They asked this question in the yeshiva, since the Geneva was in a Yar, and there are many people who visit the Yar, is Kevat Shira'u, since these people presumably witnessed, they were spectators and they saw the Geneva, is Gazlan, who, why is he Chayev Dal Vehei? He should be Chayev only Karen as a Gazlan. And the Gemara answers, Kevan de Komitmere Minaihu. Again, whatever that means, either he hides himself, or he hides himself together with the animals, he hides the animals. Anyway, he's trying to guarantee that no one should see his act of Gneva is Ganavu, therefore he qualifies as a Ganav, and he's Chayev all the Tashlumin of a Ganav, Kefel, and Dalet Vehe. Mentioned earlier that it would be possible to say that he didn't do a Mashicha here, Biyadayim, but rather he caused the animal to move by calling out Bekol, by yelling and screaming at the animal. And that's how he was able to hide the animal. The Be'iri, however, writes, back in Perek HaKones, that Kinyan Mashicha splits into two. Mekachu Memkar on the one hand, and Gneva on the other hand. And although in Mekachu Memkar, says the Me'iri, Kore lo vihiba, if he calls out to the animal and is able to get the animal to move, that itself constitutes a kinyan mashicha and a valid kinyan. That's as far as buying and selling is concerned. However, the standards and the requirements of kinyan mashicha vis-a-vis Gneva are on a higher level. And therefore, kinyan mashicha in gzela requires some sort of action in a contact between the ganav, the gazlan, and the animal itself, which would either be dragging the animal or hitting the animal. It would not be sufficient if he calls the animal and it comes. So that opens up an entire discussion here about hilchas kinyanim, and especially kinyani gneva. Are the kinyanim of a gneva, of vis-a-vis gneva, on a different plane, and perhaps the standards and requirements are more demanding in order to constitute a kinyan mishicha, kinyan gneva, than they are in general, in universal mekach umemkar. Perhaps the underlying logic of the Miri is that in every other kinyan other than Gedeva, there's Das Acharis Makna. There's, so to speak, a meeting of minds there between the Makna and the Kone, Masha Enkin in the case of Gneva. Now again, what defined Ganav here in the case of Hitmin Becharshin? After all, in the Yar, people could see him. And the answer is that he went ahead and he hid himself. That itself, Shemistater Mishara Noshim, that itself, it makes him into a Ganav, even though there are those who might see him in this publicly accessible place called a forest. In fact, there are two Edim that saw the Ganav. Are there not? Every Ganav who's brought to trial is the evidence that is adduced by the Nignav, the plaintiff against the Ganav, is two Edim. Why isn't that enough to make every Ganav by definition into a Gazlan? And the answer would seem to be that Edim are different. The Ganav knows very well that Lo Ganav Me HaEdim, he didn't steal from the witnesses. He's not afraid of the witnesses. But in the case of the Yar, where there are many people, he should be worried that various owners of animals will see his Gneva. And if he hides himself from them, then he's a Ganav. He's not interested in the Edim. He shouldn't be afraid of the Edim. And he's not, because those Edim are not owners of animals, necessarily. And in other explanations, we find that in Charshin, even though he's stealing in a public place, and therefore he should be a Gazlan, it's not like the case where a classical case where a Ganav stealthily digs his way in, breaks into a house at night, and he's not a Gazlan because even if two people see him, it's not a public place. Here, it's a public place in the case of Yar. And this is the pretty radical chiddush, that even in a public place, Rabbi Elazar says you are a Ganav and not a Gazlan if you're hiding from people. The Meiri writes, Shemistater me'anoshim, that since he's hiding from people, areu ganav afalpi, even though there are those who see him, acherim roim oso. In other words, he is careful that people shouldn't see him, although inevitably somebody will see him in this public place. That's the chiddush, that since he took care to hide himself, he is a ganav and not a gazlan. Now, the Meiri writes that ba'ofen she'eino miskavein lokachas b'derech seiser hareyu gazlan. If he took it in a way that he indicates that he doesn't care about others seeing him, he's a gazlan. The Tosis Rid has a slightly different approach to this sugya of hitmin b'charshin, and he writes that the fundamental distinction between a ganav and a gazlan is whether the Bailim see him. If the Bailim will see him, that's called a Gazlan. If the Bailim don't see him, he's called a Ganav. Even if he doesn't hide himself from other people, but he hides himself from the owner of the object, the Nignav, that itself makes him into a Ganav. And we mentioned before the Meiri. The Meiri says that if he hides himself from people, he's called a Ganav, and that's what the Gemara brings here in the case of Hitmin Becharshin. Summarizing a machlokes between the Meiri and the Tosfos Rid, as far as the standard of Ganav, when are you mufka from Gzela, you're placed and subcategorized as a Ganav for Tashlume, Kefal, and Dalvehei. The Meiri says as long as you're hiding from people in general, whereas the Tosfos Rid puts all the emphasis on the Nignav, the Bailim. Are you hiding from the Bailim or are you not hiding from the Bailim? And those are two interpretations of Hitmin Becharshin. Is Hitmin Becharshin means you're making sure that people around you don't see you, that's the Meiri. Or Hitmin Becharshin means you're making sure that the Bailim don't see you, or that the shepherd doesn't see you. The Gemara now raises the question, Ela gazlan hechidami. So what is a gazlan? What is the scenario of a gazlan? Describe it for me. Such that you're not chayev tashlume gneva. And the answer is, says the Gemara, Amar Avo, Kigon Binayo ben Yehoyadin Tanakh in Shmuel, Shenemar, that the Tanakh describes Binayo as Vayigzol Esachanis Viyara Mitzri Vayargeu Bechanisa. He actually grabs the sword, as it were, from the hands of the Mitzri and he kills the Mitzri. And the word here is Vayigzol, which means Gzela. And gzela means he grabs it out of his hand, what we call in modern Hebrew chatifa miyada. And that by Benayo is called vayigzol, that constitutes gzela. Which means that according to the Meiri's pshat, he's not hiding himself from anyone, from Shara Noshim. Had he hidden himself from Shara Noshim, that would make him into a ganov. And the Gemara's proof from Benayo is that he's not afraid of anyone. According to Tosus Rid, what we're talking about is that he's not afraid of the Bailim. He grabs it from the Bailim and he looks him in the eyes, so to speak, figuratively. And that itself makes him into a gazlan. Rabbi Yochanan Omar, Rabbi Yochanan has a different source in Tanakh to describe and define a gazlan. Kigon Balei Shechem. These were the people who rebelled against Avimelech in Shoftim, Perktes, Shedemar, Vayasimulo, Bale Shechem, Me'arvim. Right, an Orev is a someone who's in ambush. Al Roshe Hehorim, Vayigzalu Es Kol Asher Yavar Alehem Badorach. The word Gzela here appears in this pasuk vayigzalu, and again we're talking about grabbing something out of someone's hand. And the Gemara now is going to ask the following question: Rabbi Avo, my taima lo amar mihai. Why didn't Rabbi Avo quote the pasuk in Shoftim that Rabbi Yochanan invoked? And we're going to soon see that the Mefarshim want to know why the Gemara didn't first ask why Rabbi Yochanan didn't quote Rabbi Avo and his pasuk. In any event, now the Gemara is focused on what Rabbi Avo might have found as a kind of a loophole, a derivation from Binayo. Amar lecha, Rabbi Avo says, Kevan dimitmere itmure. Why didn't Rabbi Avo quote the pasuk of Balei Shechem and Shoftim? Because in the case of the Balei Shechem, they were actually hiding themselves. And that's what we saw in the pasuk, Vayasimelo Balei Shechem Me'arvin. Me'arvin means an ambush. They hid themselves and then they jumped out of the ambush. Is lo gazlonin in who? Those who hide themselves are ganovim and not gazlonin. And this is fascinating. Even though at some point at the end of this process, it would seem Vayigzalu, that they actually grabbed it out of their hands, but nevertheless, since preparing such, they hid themselves, that makes them into gazlonim rather than ganovim. I'm sorry, that makes them into ganovim rather than gazlonim. Rabbi Yochanan is not impressed by this kasha based on the word me'arvim. Even the case of the Balei Shechem, it still constitutes gzela, even though they hid themselves. Why did they hide themselves? Not for the reason that they were afraid of other people, that these people would see them and know about their dastardly gzela, but rather delo nichzinu inshe v'na'arku minayu. They had their victims that they want to steal from. You know, this is the Wild West, you know, and White Earp. You know, they're gonna jump on this wagon and steal everything. That's gazlanim. But they hid themselves initially so that people wouldn't run away with all their objects, their valuables, because they're afraid of gzela. This was just part of the ploy of exploiting and maximizing the benefits and the success of the gzela to get as much gold and silver as they possibly could. Now, it's we indicated a question here as to why the Gemara didn't ask the question in the opposite direction. Why didn't Rabbi Yochanan invoke the pasuk of Rabbi Avo from Shmuel Beis? And the Shita Mekubetzes says that in truth Rabbi Yochanan accepts Rabbi Avo. Rabbi Yochanan brought a pasuk from Shechem and Shoftim to be mechadish, an additional chiddush, that even though these people hid themselves and they came out of an ambush, nevertheless they still are gazlanim, because the reason why they hid themselves in order to maximize the success of their gzeilus so that no one would run away from them. So it comes out according to the Shita Mekubetzes that Rabbi Yochanan never argued with Rabbi Avo. He was just expanding the definition of a gazlan to include even cases where the gazlan initially hides himself. The Gemara now raises the question, the Shalu Talmidov Es Rabbi Yochanan and Zakai. The Gemara has never really addressed the issue as the, shall we say, the rational question as to why the Ganav pays Kefel Adalat Ve and the Gazlan does not. We've addressed the question as to who and what constitutes a Ganav, a Gneva, what constitutes a Gzela, but why does the Torah make this fundamental distinction? And that was the question that was asked to the Rebbe, to Rabbi Yochanan and Zakim, and Meimach Mira Torah Beganov Yosef Migazlan. The Gazlan pays Karen and only Karen. And perhaps the underlying premise of the question of the Talmidim is that maybe we should be more machmir against and impose greater penalties on someone who's bold and brazen as opposed to someone who has an element of tznius. We always find that if someone hides his avera, he's on a lower level. He's at least, you know, his conscience is bothering him. You know, the potential for tshuva is that much greater. And the Gemara is now going to answer that in the case of a ganov, paradoxically, dafka, because he's afraid of people, that engenders an element, a dimension of chilul Hashem in his criminal act of gneva that doesn't exist in gazlan. Amar lahem, Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai responds to his talmidim, ze hishva kvod eved lekvod kono. In the case of the gazlan, his relationship to both human beings and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, his maker, is equal. He's not afraid of people, he's not afraid of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but it's all on the same level. But Zev, in the case of a ganov, lo hishva kvod eved lekvod kono, he is hiding himself from human beings. He couldn't care less about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. In other words, the ganov realizes full well that even if he's in, you know, hidden by the cloak of night and human beings will not see him, but God sees him, and therefore he gives more coverage, so to speak, more honor to people than he does to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore he shows himself to be a kofar, a denier of Hashkokis. He says God is not going to intercede here. Schar V'Onesh is not a mitigating factor to inhibit the ganov. He doesn't care about Schar V'Onesh. He's going to care just about getting caught. He's afraid of other people, but he's not afraid of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It reminds me of the famous story about Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, that he was once traveling with someone by wagon, and the wagon driver stopped at a certain point and got off the wagon, and he was about to steal something. And he asked Rabbi Yisrael, not obviously not knowing who he was, please, you stand guard here and make sure that nobody comes and sees what I'm doing. And if somebody comes, please notify me immediately, so I'll hide and I'll get back to the wagon before they catch me. And immediately as the driver started doing what he was doing, his criminal acts, Rabbi Yisrael yelled, Mizet, Mizet, that's a Yiddish phrase saying, they see you, they see you. And when the driver came back, hearing those shouts of warning, he says, what are you talking about? There's no one here. And this happened three times until finally the wagon driver got so angry at Rabbi Yisrael, and he says to him, what is with you? So Rabbi Yisrael says, Mezet, they see you up in heaven. The Gazlan, on the other hand, he's not a kofar. He is at least, consistently not afraid of anyone. You know, he's just interested in the final outcome. He wants to pocket all the gold and silver. He wants to steal all the jewelry, and he is bold and brazen against HaKadosh Baruch Hu and against people. So he's not making this distinction between Lamala and Lamata. The Gemara describes the Ganav as Kaviyachal Osa Ayin Shalmata Ki'ilu Eino Roe, the Ozen Shalmata Ki'ilu Eino Shomas. Usually in Chazal we describe HaKadosh Baruch Hu's supervision over human beings as an Ayin. There's an Ayin Lamala. Here the Gemara wants to emphasize that this Ganav is doing everything in the reverse order. So the Gemara emphasizes that it's an Ayin Shalmata. You know, he's worried about the Ayin Shalmata, the people here, and he wants to make sure that the Ayin doesn't see him, the spectators won't see him, he hides himself. And the Ozen Shalmata, in his mind, is a reference to HaKadosh Baruch. HaKadosh Baruch doesn't hear what's going on in this world. And perhaps it's a reference to the fact that the Nignav, the victim, is going to cry out to Hashem to do justice here against the Ganav. He's not interested in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Ozen. He's not, he doesn't pay any attention, this Ganav, to the Ozen of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There may be other reasons offered, again, not in this sugya, but by the Mefarshim, as to why the Ganav deserves a more profound penalty than the Gazlan. First of all, in the case of Gneva, we have to worry about the fact that since he stole it stealthily and nobody sees him, it's going to be much more difficult, almost impossible, for the Nignav to retrieve his stolen goods. And therefore the Torah is saying that the criminal act of the Gneva, of the Ganav, is even more severe. He deserves a greater punishment. Keep in mind also that in the case of a Gazlan, he sort of embarrasses himself publicly, whereas the Ganav, nobody sees him, he doesn't suffer that bizui b'masav, and the Torah is more machmir upon him. Also, in general, perhaps, Gneva is more commonplace than Gzela, and we know that to be true even in our contemporary times, and therefore the Torah had to be more machmir on a Ganav to try to inhibit Gneva. In any event, getting back to this description of the evil of a Ganav, the Gemara now goes and then quotes a pasuk in Yeshayahu HaNavi. Yeshayahu is complaining about those who perpetrate evil, and these Rishayim are Kofrim, Bashkochas Hashem, and he says, Hoy Hamamikim Me'ashem Lastir Eitzah, V'hoya b'machshach ma'aseihem. And then the pasuk says, "Vayomru mi roenu umi yodeenu." These rishoyim are ma'amikim b'machshavtam. In other words, in the depths of their thought, they try to schedule, they try to arrange it in such a way that they hide themselves and their evil from God, as if to say, you know, God is not concerned; He doesn't supervise in what's going on in this land, down on this earth. And therefore, they do what they do, bechoshech, and they're chotim, they're sinners. Uksiv, and he has another pasuk, in David HaMel says, in Tilim, Vayomru lo yireyah, v'lo yovin Eloi Yaakov, the Rishayim who do their evil, portray evil, they declare, God doesn't see them, He doesn't hear them, He's not interested in what goes on in this earth, and therefore they don't have any fear of God. Uksiv, again, the Ganav has fear of man, and he doesn't have fear of God. Uksiv, and the pasuk, a third pasuk in Yechezkel, ki omru ozav Hashem es ha'aretz v'ein Hashem roeh. And again, all these Rishoyim and all these three psukim are kofer bashkochas Hashem. God doesn't see, God doesn't care, and in effect, they are denying the fundamental principle of schar v'yonesh, and therefore they're not inhibited, and they go ahead and sin. The Gemara now further clarifies the difference between a gadav and a gazlan by quoting a brisa of Rabbi Meir. Omer Rabbi Meir, Mashalo Mashal. I will give you a simile. And this simile, this metaphor, he heard originally Mishum Rav Gamliel, Lemad Dover Dome, Lishnei B'nei Odom Shayu Be'ir V'yosu Mishteh. The difference between a gadav and a gazlan can be compared to two people in a city or a town that hosted a banquet. Echad zimen es bnei ha'ir v'lo zimen es bnei ha'melech. One of them invites the members of the city, the local citizens, but he deliberately omits the king's family. The royal family is not invited to his mishteh. Everyone else is. The echad, and another person is so stingy, lo zimen es bnei ha'ir v'lo zimen es bnei ha'melech. He doesn't invite anyone. He just makes this mishteh for his immediate family, or perhaps his immediate friends and relatives and neighbors. Eza mehen onsho meruba. Rav Gamliel says, which one of the two deserves a more severe punishment? Avi Omer, the answer is zeshe zimen es bnei ha'ir v'lo zimen es bnei ha'melech. What a slap in the face it is to the king that he invites everyone but the bnei ha'melech. He's mechabed the members of the city more than he is the family, the royal family. That is a very severe sin. And in the case of the ganav, he's afraid of human beings, he's not afraid of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he deserves a greater and more severe punishment than that of a gazlan, who's not afraid neither from people nor from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He doesn't invite anyone to the party. The Gemara explains now the difference between tvicha and mechira of a shor, and tvicha mechira of a seh. In the case of a shor, the Torah says you pay hay, you pay five times. In the case of a seh, you only pay four times. And Omer Rabbi Meir explains that distinction. Bo rei kama gadol koach shel melacha. Shor shebitlo mi melachto chamisha. Seh shelo bitlo mi melachto arba. In the case of a shor is a work animal, right? This is an ox that's used for plowing, etc. What the ganav did was he undermined the ability of the nignav, the bailim, to use this shor for malacha, for heavy duty work. And therefore he deserves a more severe punishment of chamisha, in contrast to the case of a seh, a lamb, a shepsula, shelo bitlo mimalachta, because generally speaking, a seh is not used for heavy duty work. And therefore the Torah had more compassion on the ganav who either slaughtered or sold a seh, and therefore he only pays dalit. The obvious objection that one could raise in understanding this sugya is a ganav, even without tvicha mechira, he stole the animal. So why shouldn't the Torah have been machmir on shor more than on seh? For example, if seh, which is not a work animal, engenders a chiv kefel for the ganav itself, then shor should engender a chiv gimel. You know, we should somehow jack up the punishment. But apparently, as opposed to tvicha mechira, which is permanent, ganava is viewed only as temporary, because hopefully, and this is the case we're talking about, we were able to track down the ganav, and with evidence of Edom, we were able to testify against him, he's going to return the animal. So it was only a kind of a temporary undermining of the malacha of the Baal HaShor. The Marsha says that if we're dealing with bittul malachto, then let's say if the ganav steals a young egel, which is not yet a shor, and the animal at this age is not roi lemalachto, you're going to have to say that the bitul malachto, which engenders a chiv hay in the case of an egel, is because asidu ligdol. The animal is going to grow up, mature, and then it'll be roi lemalacha rabba. But now, says the Marsha, let's read Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. He gives another reason to explain the difference between Dalet and Hay. Om Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, this is pretty famous, Bo ure'e kama gadol kovadak brios. In other words, the Torah is so sensitive, even to a ganav, Sharsha holech baragla, holech baragla, and as the ganav didn't lower himself in the case of a shor to carry the animal on his shoulders, and therefore
he pays chamisha, the Torah has no compassion for that gonev who stole a shor and then he was tovech or mocher, but seh, the Torah considers the humiliation of the ganov as one of the factors to be added to this equation. Sheh hirkivo al ksefo, he took this little shepsula and he carried it on his back, is therefore the Torah had compassion on him and with leniency reduced his punishment to arba. Says the Marsha, according to this logic, that it all depends on halach baraglov or not. If, let's say, he steals a young ox, meaning an eagle, and the eagle is small enough and light enough so that he carries the eagle on his shoulders, logically in such a case, the Torah, because of the humiliation element here in the Gneva, should have been more lenient and should only be Mechayev him Dalit. Again, what you'll have to introduce is some sort of a low plug. But according to the first reasoning, points out to Marsha, even if he takes a young egel, nevertheless he is robbing the Nignav of the ultimate Malacha that this egel will, when it matures to be a Shar, will be able to afford for the Ganav. And now it's no longer possible because he's got all these cash, because the Ganav shechted the animal, or because it was sold and it'll never be returned to the Nignav. The Shita Megubetzes here is wondering, according to the second logic, that of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, right, Sheher Kivo al Ksefoi pays only Dalit in the case of a Seh, then Lechora, in every case of Gneva of a Shar, he should pay Shlosha, because since the Shar walks on its own 2 feet, therefore the Torah should have been lenient. The Torah would be more machmer in the case of Shar. Why is it that the Torah, as we asked before, makes this distinction only between only in the case of Tvicha u'mechira do we find this distinction between Shar and Seh? L'chor, it's relevant to the Gneva itself. Again, when we asked that question on Rabbi Meir, the first explanation, so we suggested that the Bittul Malach in the case of Gneva, when the Ganav is caught, is much more limited and temporary than if the Ganav completely got rid of the animal. But if we go with the second explanation of Yochanan ben Zakkai, why shouldn't this distinction of how much the Ganav should be penalized in Shar versus Seh should apply to the Gneva itself, or to the Kefil itself? And he answers the following. He says that since the Ganav is Mischayev immediately when he takes the animal outside of the Shus HaBailim, then at this point we're not going to judge and we're not going to analyze, did the animal go with its feet by its own, four feet, or did the Ganav have to put the animal on his shoulders, because the chiyuv is engendered immediately with the gneva, even before the animal is carried from place to place. In the case of tvicha mechira, on the other hand, then we assume, as a general rule, that the ganav had to transport the animal to another place where he did the shechita, where he did the mechira. He takes it into his house, perhaps, the ganav. And therefore, there's a whole derech over here. Derech meaning the traveling here, the transportation. And the ganav, in the case of a shor, has an easy time, relatively, not humiliating himself in transportation, whereas in the case of the seh, herkival ksefo, and that element of humiliation comes to the fore. Introducing the new Mishnah. Until now, the Masechta has dealt with the dinim of Nezikin, of an animal, Doraisa. Now the Mishnah wants to establish certain dinim derabbanan that are relevant to animals. And we've already had the dinim of Tashlumei Arba V'Chamisha, and those apply to what's called a Behema Daka, and we'll see about that. Now we're going to talk about Behema Daka in Eretz Yisrael. We're going to talk about Knossos in Chutz Laretz. There's no Knoss in Chutz Laretz. The Mishnah is going to bring these Dinim and try to talk about Tashlume Dalet Vehei in the Midbarios of Eretz Yisrael. There you're allowed to raise a Behema Daka. And the Mishnah says the following: Ein Megadlim Behema Daka be Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, there's a mitzvah Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, and when the Jews take up domicile in the land, then there is an isur, as Rashi says, to be mafsid Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, to do something that would cause a loss and make Eretz Yisrael desolate. And a behemah daka has a tendency of eating grass and other vegetations in the fields, and it's going to be mafsid the sodos of Bnei Yisrael. And the truth is that even in one's house, a person should not raise a behemah, because at the end of the day, the animal is going to graze outside of his house. That's called liros bachutz. And liros bachutz is something that's also, even with regard to behemah gasa. The Mishnah is formulating a distinction between two categories of behemoths, as we'll learn. Behemah gasa is one category, a behemah daka is another category. The chiddush here of behemah daka is that liros is not liros bachutz, because then that again, as I emphasize, is also even a behemah gasa in Eretz Yisrael, but rather even also legadel afilu bebeso, even his house. That's how far they went with this isur of a behemah, of raising a behemah daka in Eretz Yisrael. And Tosis Yontif points out here in Mishnayis that not only are we afraid that if he raises the behemah daka in his house, ultimately it's going to go out and it's going to be grazing in the pasture lands, in the fields of Eretz Yisrael, but also even within the house, he has a certain volume of zroim that are growing right there in his private property, and those zroim will now be eaten by this behemah daka. That also is called a hefse to the yishuv. And Tosus points out that the iser of legadol behemah daka b'Eretz Yisrael applies afilu al yidei nesinasa leroesh yigadlena. Even if the animal is going to be supervised by a shepherd who's being hired to raise the animal, nevertheless, it's considered part of this isur. The Tosfos and the Rashba also quote another opinion that he's not allowed to raise, the owner's not allowed to raise the animal, but if he gives it over to a roeh, to a shepherd, that's mutter. Now, the Mishnah goes on to say, Avol Megadlim Bisuria. Suria is what's called Aram Tzova. This is the area of Kibush Yochid. David HaMelech conquered this land even before the lands of Eretz Yisrael were under Jewish dominion. And the Kedusha of Aram Tzova of Suria is not the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. And therefore the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael will not apply, because Kibush Yochid, Lav Shmei Kibush, the sugya at the beginning of Masech the Gittner, two opinions about this, but our Mishnah reflects the opinion that Kibush Yochid is not Shmei Kibush. Suria does not have Kedushas Eretz Yisrael, and therefore the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael and the Easter be Mafsid the Yishuv Eretz Yisrael does not apply to Suria as it applies to other places in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore it has the status of Chutz Laretz and Mutal Gadel Sham Behema Daka. There's no Isur of raising Behema Daka in Suria as there is no Isur in Eretz Yisrael. And even again, if there'll be some sort of Hefseid through these Behemas to Sodos, then you know what? There's recourse to sue the owner of the animal in Bezdin for damages and to receive compensation. The Hefseid to the Yish of Eretz Yisrael as an end into itself does not apply outside the bounds of Eretz Yisrael. The Ramban, in his commentary, not to this week's Parsha, but next week's Parsha, explains why is it that kibush yachid lav shmei kibush? And he says that the conditions that have to be met in order to establish and engender a kedushas haaretz were not met at the time that David went out to battle to conquer Syria, Tiram Tzova, because he did not confer with Urim Vitumim, he did not confer with Sanhedrin, he went out and he did this kibush. And that kibush is not an obligatory kibush. Maybe it's a melchemes reshus, but certainly not a melchemes mitzvah. And as long as David HaMelech had not yet clinched, had not yet succeeded in being Morish all seven nations in Eretz Yisrael, then the mitzvah of kibush does not apply outside the bounds. Only afterwards, once the seven nations were subdued and Jewish dominion over Eretz Yisrael proper was established, only then could there be a mitzvah, a chovas kibush, to another land. The Rambam, in his Pirush HaMishnayos, not here in Bava Kamma, but in Masechet Dmai, says the same idea. And according to those who say the kibush yachid shmei kibush, the Ramban again expands and he says that even though David HaMelech did not implement the exact sequence as he should have, meaning the Seder that was necessary is first Zion Amim in Eretz Yisrael proper and only then Aram Tzov, nevertheless, once he conquered the land, he fulfilled the mitzvah of Kol Mokom Asher Tidrach Kaf Raglechem Bo Lachem Yeh, and therefore Syria is considered a part of Eretz Yisrael. Then the Mishnah says, and you can hear the word chen, v'chen b'midbariyo shel Eretz Yisrael, there there's no yishuv at all, and therefore there's not a chshash of hefseid. In other words, the isur of being megadol b'medakan so only applies to that part of the land that has a yishuv. It's not a din that applies universally to any land that is sanctified with kedushas Eretz Yisrael. And the nafkamina is going to be a place where there was no yishuv, a place that's part of Eretz Yisrael, but is not subject to Yishuv. And that is, in the classical sense, a Midbar. But truth be told, there may be parts of Eretz Yisrael that technically are not part of a Midbar, and they too would be excluded from this Isur, because there's no Yishuv in those, if there's befall no Yishuv in those places. And certainly, there were periods of time in which Eretz Yisrael was not in Jewish control, and the Jews were not living in the land. Those Jews, few Jews who did live in the land in those periods of time, would not be subject to the Iser of Ein Legadol BeMedaka Eretz Yisrael, because there was no Yishuv at that period of time. The Mefarsha HaMishnayis raised the following question. The Mishnah, as we'll soon see, mentions Taros. And we'll discuss why in a minute, but what's interesting is the Mishnah omits mention of Trumos. And one would think that this Iser of being Megadol BeMedaka of Eretz Yisrael should be related to Trumos as well. We don't want to be Mafsid Truma from the Kohen. And the Teferes Yisrael in Yochin says that since the Kohanim eat Truma, who eat Truma, have to be Shomer, all their Kalim Betahara, and therefore Memele, even now that they don't have Truma in the Batim, Osalehem Legadol Tarnagolim, because of the Chash that they would be Metame the Kalim, and therefore the Mishnah mentions Taros and not Trumos. So in our attempt to further clarify this point of the Tiferes Yisrael, let's read the next din, which is presented here in the Mishnah, Megadlin Tarnagolim B'Yushalayim. In other words, with regard to Tarnagolim, even though the person who's raising these Tarnagolim is a Jew, nevertheless he's enjoined from raising them in Yushalayim. Yushalayim is a place where there's a lot, a large volume of kodshim, and trumos. Says the Mishnah, Mipnei HaKodshim, we eat Kodshim in Yerushalayim. Apparently a reference to Kodshim Kalim, which could be eaten anywhere in Yerushalayim. Basa Shlomim, Toda, Maisa Behema, Rashi stipulates here. And there's a large volume of these karbonos that are eaten, the Basa Kodshim Kalim, in Yerushalayim. And the Derech of Tarnagolim, the nation of Tarnagolim, is such that they go into the Ashpa. You know, that's where they peck away and try to get food. And in the Ashpa, there may be sherets, shrotzim, basa sherets. Again, the shear, the minimum shear of basa sherets for tumah is going to be an adasha. And now, once these tarnagolim peck away and they come in contact with basa sherets, now they are tmeim and they will be metame kodshim. Velo kohanim, the Eretz Yisrael Mipnei Hataros. Now, as far as the land of Eretz Yisrael outside the bounds of Yerushalayim, here there's an Iser of Gidol Tarnagolim, but it doesn't apply universally to all Jews, but rather it only applies to the Kohanim. And the reason why the Kohanim are enjoined from raising Tarnagolim anywhere in Eretz Yisrael is Mipnei Hataharos. And Taharos is a reference to Truma. The Kohanim eat Truma, that's called Kodshei Gvul, anywhere in Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, there's a chash with regard to the Truma that it might come in contact with Tuma. And that's an Isur to be Metame Trumos. And that will be engendered by these Tarnagolim, because again, the Tarnagolim, since they're Menaker in these Ashpos, where there's a possibility of coming in contact with Basa Sheretz, of Ashir of Anadash, as we mentioned before, therefore these Tarnagolim are now going to peck away and have contact with the Truma, and they're going to be Metami the Truma. So wherever there's a vast volume of Truma, i.e. in the houses of the Kohanim, anywhere in Eretz Yisrael, that's where we have to be careful about Tarnagolim. And therefore the Mishnah enjoins the Kohanim in their homes, anywhere in Eretz Yisrael, from raising these Tarnagolim. Now, when we talk about Truma, we have to be careful about the Kalim, the utensils into which the Truma is placed. And they may even be eating utensils, whatever it is. And those Kalim have to remain Tahorim. Therefore, if not for the issue of the Kalim, let's just isolate for 1 minute the issue of the Kalim, and let's talk about the direct contact between the Tarnagolim and the Truma. Let's say, for example, in a certain period of time, the Kohanim are not eating Truma. They don't have, right now, any Truma in their homes. In such a case, maybe they could be Megadol Tarnagolim as long as there's no Truma around. And that's why the Mishnah says that Tiferes Yisrael, that we indicated earlier, does not mention Trumos, but rather mentions Taharos. Taharos is a word that includes the Kalim. And a Kohen has to be careful about the Kalim in his house, Umetum, meaning in general, whether he has Truma at this moment or he doesn't have Truma at this moment. And therefore, even if he doesn't have Truma at this moment in his house, the Truma is not available, nevertheless he has to be careful about not raising Tarnagolim, because these Tarnagolim will be Metame, the Kalim that he has in his house. As far as Yisraelim are concerned, Yisraelim are allowed or permitted to be Megadol Tarnagolim outside of Yerushalayim. And what about those Yisraelim who are Ochlim Chulin Betara? They treat Chulin as if it were Kodshim. In such a case, one would ostensibly argue that they, these Yisraelim, Ochlim Truma, Ochlim Chulin Betara, should be careful about Tarnagolim even outside of Yerushalayim. Says the Meiri, that level of Isur that those Yisraelim took upon themselves voluntarily not to eat Chulin Bituma, but rather to eat Chulin as if it was Kodshim Bitara, That's not the same level of a violation as being mitame kodshim or being mitame truma, and therefore the Mishnah was not machmir on Yisraelim outside of Yerushalayim, where there's no chashash of kodshim, even though there might be chashash of truma, and even though they eat chulin betaras truma. Nevertheless, that Easter, even if Chas V'Shalom would be violated because the Tarnagolim would peck away at the Chulin, that's not the same level of Easter. The Mishnah goes on to say, Ein Megadlin Chazirim B'chol Mokom, we prohibit raising Chazirim, that swine, anywhere, even in Chutz Laretz. And we're going to analyze the reason for this momentarily, but now the Mishnah says, additionally, lo yigadol odom es hakelev, a person should not raise a canine, a dog, anywhere, even in Chutz Laretz. Again, presumably because of the danger of raising such an animal. We'll have to see which kind of dogs are included here. A dog that has rabies, a dog that might scream and yell and scare someone, and that would damage him. Elim Kain Hoya, unless this dog kosher b'shalsheles was properly watched and guarded, tied down with chains, literally. And finally, the mission establishes Ein Parson Nishovim Layonim. Nishovim are certain nets that would catch the doves. And the reason for that is that maybe these doves belong to the members of the yishuv, those who are living there. And if you put out these traps, you might violate these gzela. Elim kein hayarachok min hayishuv shloshim ris, unless the place where you're placing these nets and these traps is distant from the yishuv by 4 milim, a vast amount of distance, because the yonim, when they the doves move away from their local homes for a certain distance, but not as far as Shloshim Ris, and therefore we're not afraid that he's going to capture the Yonim of someone that are privately owned. Before we move on to discuss the Chazirim, I'd like to first go back to the Tarnagolim. The Tarnagolim, say the Poskim, are not allowed to be raised in Yerushalayim by anyone, or outside of Yerushalayim in Eretz Yisrael by Kohanim. That's only if you leave the Tarnagolim free to roam through the streets of the city, and there there's chashash that it yanakru be'ashpa, and they'll bring tumah into the house. But if he raises the Tarnagolim only in the lulim, only in the coops, that's mutter. Because then there's no chashash that these Tarnagolim will be metame kodshim or taras or trumos. And it's very interesting that if you look in the pasuk in Melachim Aleph with regard to Shulchan Shlomo HaMelech, it seems that every day there were barburim, there were these kinds of ducks, avusim, and these were Tarnagolim mefutamim. Why wasn't there an Easter in raising these in Yerushalayim Ir HaKodesh? And the answer is that these were raised only in lulim. If you take a look at the Gemara in Yuma and Daf Chaf, there was a truma on a daily basis to the Mizbeach that took place close to the time of Kriyas HaGever, early in the morning. The Gemara has a machlokas amoroim. What is Kriyas HaGever? According to Rabbi Shilo, that's Kriyas HaTarnagolim. And it seems that they were raising Tarnagolim in Yerushalayim. The answer is that was in chicken coops. Now, to talk a little bit about Chazirim, we will mention a brisa that's going to be quoted here on Daf Pei Beis Amid Beis, Kishetzaru Beis Chashmonoim Zel Zeh. There was a friction within the Beis Chashmonoi historically, and Hurkanus was Bifnim, and Aristobulus was Mibachutz, and every day Hayu Mishalshin Lahem Bekupa Dinorim, Hayimalim Lahem Tmidim, and Hayasham Zokin Echad Shayamakir Bechokhma Yevonis Omer Lahem Kolzman Sha Oskim Beavoda Ein Nimsarim Biyodnam. Lemachar shilshul dinamim bekupa vehela lahem chazir. Kevin shegil achatzi achoma noat tziparnov bechoma nizdazea eretz yisol arbamios parsal arbios parsbil sesha omru oru ha'ish shiigadol chazirim oru ha'onam shiilamed espino chachma yivonis.
So as a result of this unfortunate incident, back in the time of the Chashmonaim, as recorded in the Braisa later on in this Masechta, they caught a chazir instead of an animal, and they were bringing it up as a carbon tamid. And there was a zaken who understood Chachma Yevanis, and as a result of this whole incident, Chazal made a takana that we have to avoid chazirim entirely, because this chazir came to the choma, to the walls of Yerushalayim, the tzipon of the choma, and then all of Eretz Yisrael shook. Again, what the deeper meaning is, and what it has to do with Chachma Yevanis and Yirtzeh Hashem, but Neder we'll get to in just a few days, probably the beginning of next week. The Rambam writes in his Pirush HaMishnayos here that you're not allowed to raise even other behemoths and chayas that you're not allowed to eat. And that the Mishnah just mentions one example of a behemoth mea, of a chazir, because it was well known that it's possible to raise these chazirim like bakar and son, and it was quite common to do so. Tosus, on the other hand, later on in this perek, is going to say that the isur only applies to chazir and not to other animals, and Bli Neder will get to that down the line. With regard to klovim again, we're talking about what's called a kelev ra, and you may remember that in the Gemara back on Daf Mem Vav, also legato kelev ra bebeso, shenema lo tosim dom veisecha, and that's what's being recorded here in our Mishnah. Again, when we speak about the animal, the dog, jumping out and screaming and fear and creating fear and shock, this is especially true, the Gemara is going to say later on, with regard to a pregnant woman who could actually lose her fetus as a result of this kelev that jumps out and starts screaming. And I'm wondering, even today, whether or not there are halachas that should be applied, for at least to religious people who are willing to accept them here in Yerushalayim, with regard to some of these massive dogs that really scare the daylights out of you. Again, with regard to Yonim, we said that there is a distance from the Yishuv called Shloshim Ris, which is equal to Arba Milim. And that's what Rashi explains here, Shloshim. Now, Kol Shiva Vechetzi Ris Shovim Lemil, every 7.5 Ris equals 1 mil, and therefore if you multiply 7.5 by 30, sorry, if you multiply 7.5 times 4, then you'll get 30. And if 7.5 represents 1 mil, you multiply that 1 mil, which is 7.5 ris, by 4 in order to achieve shloshim ris, what you end up is with 4 mil. Now, a mil is alpayim amah, and therefore we're talking about 4 times 2 is 8,000 amah from the city. That is a probably equivalent to about 4 miles, or maybe perhaps a little bit more than that, and that's the major distance to be marchik himself from the yishuv in order to set up his traps and catch the doves. And both I will stop here, and Bli Neder, tomorrow we'll start the Gemara.